is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Nathaniel Philbrick, Nat Philbrick. His new book is Travels with George, In Search of Washington and His Legacy. George Washington, inaugurated President of the United States in the spring of 1789, takes a series of trips to meet his people, also to say thank you, also to create the presidency. So far, in 1789, he's traveled to New England, as far north as the Kittery Point, now in Maine, then Massachusetts. He's also traveled to Long Island to visit, we think, and to thank, we think, the spy ring that was critical in his understanding of the war, the Revolution. He's also made it very clear that he wants to resolve the conflicts that are developing in his cabinet between two personages, John Adams, the vice president, who will become president, and Thomas Jefferson, the secretary of state, who will become president, and others, Alexander Hamilton. Washington is a can't we all get along guy. However, knowing that it's not possible, these trips provide him what you'd have to say, robustness. And we're about to take a trip by sail to Newport. Nat, why did Washington choose to go to Newport at this point? Was it to get out of town? This is August of 1790. To get out of town, to get away from the conflicts, something compelling him to travel to the state that didn't vote for him.
Right. Well, I think a lot of people today, if, you know, political operatives would tell the president, the last place you want to go is a place like Rhode Island, which was the last state to ratify the Constitution. You know, the biggest doubters in the country were in Rhode Island. And in fact, when Washington had gone on his New England tour, he had made every effort not to venture in Rhode Island. And he wanted to make a point there and wanted to apply pressure. And then eventually, Rhode Island enters the country and ratifies the Constitution. Washington hears of it and in August decides, spur of the moment, I'm going to go. Let's go. You know, travel by land is slow and laborious, but not so by water. New York is the temporary capital. He hops on a schooner and sails around Long Island to Newport and Providence. And, you know, and it's a brilliant move because Rhode Island, the city of the state of the greatest skeptics in the country, become some of his biggest fans. They're so thankful that he's willing to make this gesture, even though they were the last to ratify the Constitution.
You and your wife, Melissa, also made a decision to sail. It wasn't spur of the moment. You knew that Washington had sailed to Newport. You were leaving from Nantucket across Vineyard Sound for Edgartown and then on to Newport. But along the way, a storm happened. What storm, Manat? What storm?
Well, it's more than a storm. We had just left Edgartown and we were headed towards Newport. We were smack dab in the middle of a Vineyard Sound when our cell phones begin to bleat with the emergency signal. My wife, Melissa, looks at her phone and it says, tornado alert, seek shelter. And so I said, you know, when you're in a sailboat, that's kind of hard to do. We immediately donned life jackets. I turned on the engine and we started to take down the sails. Just as we began to do that, from behind us, the opposite direction of the wind, came a screaming in the sky. We couldn't see anything but a gray wall of horizontal rain, winds that were estimated to top 70 knots, blasting us. We couldn't see it, but the funnel of the waterspout or tornado was passing just to the north of us. And it would make for the most terrifying half hour on the water I have ever experienced. You know, at one point I said to Melissa, you know, and we had to scream to be heard. I said, if we die, they're going to say we died doing, you know, at least they died doing what they love. I don't love this. And but, you know, when I would look back on it, it was kind of a metaphor, if you will, of the storm-tossed political waters that were surrounding Washington.
The detail here that impressed me was that the wind was blowing so fast, there were no waves. It was flat.
Yeah.
They were being pushed over a flat gray sea where there was nothing to see.
It was eerie. It was as if, you know, I have never felt, it did not feel real. It felt like I was in the midst of a moviescape. There were no waves. It was like the hand of God had flattened the water as this screaming wind, you know, drove over us. And then when the wind began to die, you know, down into 40 knots, these waves erupted. And it was just, it was, as I said, it was terrifying and weird. And it just felt like there was a force beyond all of us that had some kind of thematic resonance with what we were doing as we followed Washington.
Arriving in Newport, we arrive to more paradoxes. You report correctly that Rhode Island is famous for tolerance, it's famous for autonomy, famous for religious independence. But at the same time, this detail from your reporting, Nat, 60% of all slave trade voyages originated in Rhode Island. Washington knew that, correct?
Yes, I have no idea that, you know, these were surreptitious and illegal in many instances. But the fact of the matter is, Rhode Island, more than any New England state, was tied to the institution of Southern slavery. You know, not only when it came to slaving voyages, Rhode Island farms provided the South Southern plantations with the provisions they needed, since all of their agriculture in the years ahead would be dedicated to cotton. And so, you know, it's the strange, quintessentially American paradox of the state, you know, that has an independent man atop its capital, you know, that prides itself in religious freedom and was so inextricably tied to the institution of slavery and absolute oppression.
Newport at time of Washington was the dominant city, but it quickly became Providence and Brown University. Nat and Melissa are graduates of Brown. Nat's father grew up in Providence, and there's a chariot in a garage where Nat's grandfather, I believe, kept his car. What was that chariot, Nat?
Yeah, it was the chariot that John Brown, one of the founders of Brown University and a slave trader, it was the chariot he had built at great expense. And it was the chariot that Brown and Washington would travel in during Washington's visit to Providence, when Brown took him on a tour of his shipyard at Fox Point, where he was building a huge China trading ship named for the president.
The depth of the Brown brothers and of Brown University and of the state of Rhode Island's involvement in the South at this point underlines again that the aspiration of the Constitution was not even close at this point. Nat, sometimes when I read these stories and think that they were practicing what Orwell calls doublethink, think you have your own independence, but at the same time, you know that you're imprisoned.
Right. I mean, this is America, because, you know, Washington wanted to have the Union, but to have the Union, if you wanted the South to be a part of it, many felt that you had to countenance slavery in some form. And, you know, of course, everyone saw that slavery would ultimately make this union impossible, and it would be delayed for the next generation, for, you know, several generations to come. But it was inevitable, and everyone knew it. Jefferson talks about it's like having the wolf by the ear. You know, what do you do if you let go the ear? The wolf will consume you. It makes all those declarations of liberty and freedom in the Declaration of Independence seem awfully hollow and, as you said, Orwellian doublespeak.
There's a tension within the Brown family. There are four Brown brothers. John Brown, we've spoken of. He was a braggart And a large man like Washington, but very rotund like Adams. He had a brother, Moses Brown, who converted to being a Quaker and who was an abolitionist. And it is your observation, Nat, that Moses Brown influenced Washington so that in January of 1794, he advanced a law that became a law of the land in March. The banning of the slave trade, is that how to read this? So that Rhode Island, after that, was doing things illegally.
Right. Yeah, it was, you know, it was the first sort of federal government statement against slavery. And it was very controversial at the time. But it was something that the abolitionists of Rhode Island put forward, and that Washington actually mentioned during one of his addresses to Congress, which outraged the Southern congressmen. And, you know, and it's something that comes, you know, was probably instigated by this trip to Providence. You know, and yet the great irony is it's Moses Brown who finances Slater Mill, you know, the mill, the cotton mill, that the textile mill that has been looked to as the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in America. And as his brother John would gleefully point out, these textile mills used the cotton that was, you know, that came from Southern slavery. And so even you have even Moses Brown, the Quaker abolitionist, tied up in this pernicious institution.
We're going south. Travels with George in Search of Washington and His Legacy. Nathaniel Philbrick is the author. It is spring 1791. George Washington in his cream-colored coach. We're going south. I'm John Batchelor.